From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Abdirahim Fakara, Washington Bureau Chief, Al Jazeera TV. Our moderator is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, David Renning.
Good day, everyone. And here are the issues. 800,000 immigrants brought to America illegally as children will hear as soon as Monday whether Donald Trump and Republicans want them to be deported or given a pathway to citizenship amid a chaotic immigration debate that at one point triggered a government shutdown. Delighting Israeli conservatives and angering Palestinians, Vice President Mike Pence said that the American embassy in Israel will move to Jerusalem by 2019. The Trump administration slapped import tariffs on solar panels and washing machines, claiming that this would create American jobs, though companies that install solar panels say that tens of thousands of jobs will actually be lost. And in Davos in Switzerland, business and political leaders at the World Economic Forum heard a speech by Donald Trump explaining why his America First policies are making his economy great again. So, Linda, let's turn to the immigration debate, which has been a perennial source of tension in American politics for a long time, but is once again at a point of kind of breaking out, testing the unity of the Republican Party, testing the unity of the Democratic Party. Most immediately, the White House has said that it will very soon bring out a proposal which they're calling extremely generous, which they say meets the demands of many Democrats to do something for the so-called dreamers, these people who came to the U.S. Through no fault of their own as children without the right legal papers and who've been in something of a kind of limbo since the protections they got under the Obama administration were sort of put on hold by Trump. So the Republicans and the White House say this is a very generous deal that Democrats will love because it offers protections for the dreamers. Is this a deal that Democrats will love, and will this end the debate next week?
Well, the details have already leaked out, and the Democrats have already soundly rejected it because even though in a narrow way that arrangement does sound generous, in fact, it covers 1.8 million young undocumented immigrants.
Which is more than the Obama scheme covered.
Exactly. So it sounds generous, but it's part of a larger package that contains some poison pills. It contains dramatic reductions in legal immigration, the biggest cut since the 1920s. It ends the visa lottery, which is meant to diversify immigration into the United States. And so there's something in there for everybody to love, but something for everybody to hate. And therefore, it's dead on arrival.
And that's really interesting that you talk about legal immigration, because is there a sense that this is something new? So we're used to years and years of arguing about illegal immigration and people who came without the right papers or people who overstayed their visas. There's perhaps 11 or 12 million people living in the United States at the moment without the right legal papers. Mm-hmm. So they have been a kind of political hot potato for a long time. But since Trump became president, we hear people also saying, actually, American workers suffer when people are allowed in perfectly legally, the right way to get jobs. Do you sense that that camp pushing for restrictions on legal immigration is in the ascendant at the moment?
Well, it is among Trump supporters. So this is part of the great divide in America. America sees itself as a very welcoming country for people who enter the country legally and who immigrate legally. This country was built on immigration. You know, you can count to, you know, many famous Americans who were born in other countries, who saw the opportunity in this country, moved here with their family, people from Sergey Brin at Google to Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist. Now, there is, among a certain segment of the population who tend to support Donald Trump, there's alarm over the so-called browning of America and over a sense that they, sort of the working class of this country, have lost job opportunities to immigrants. And so that sense of threat is there, and that's the camp that President Trump is playing to.
Do you think there's a parallel here with the debate about free trade and protectionism? You know, if you go back not very long in American history, the Republican Party was the pro-business party, and they basically thought that free trade was a good thing, and sort of foreign companies investing in the US was basically a good thing, and companies being allowed to build factories wherever they liked so they could make profits was basically in everyone's interests. Donald Trump has completely overthrown that view, put in place much more of a kind of protectionist, create barriers to trade. Do you think there's a parallel with people that in some ways wanting to restrict the right of people to come and look for jobs in this country is kind of protectionism for people? And that never used to be the Republican position, but it's very popular, it turns out, with a lot of rank and file Republican voters.
No, this is absolutely true. And it's, as you say, it is part of this larger, I think, fear of the other, fear of people from other country and fear of trade with other countries. Now, Americans, of course, benefit tremendously from free trade. You know, when you look at the cost of things, you can go to a Walmart or to any store, basically, and look at how cheap things are compared to, say, 20, 30 years ago relative to people's incomes. But there are segments of the country where people have been hurt by free trade. When NAFTA was instituted, the North American Free Trade Agreement, there were provisions put in place to help the people who were displaced by free trade and by expanded trade. But in some cases, they didn't either take up the offer, they didn't take up the job training to start a new career, or they were just too old for whatever reason. It just hasn't really worked the way it might have. And so there is this undercurrent of resentment about both people from other countries and about imports and about the difficulties for some American industries to export its products.
And that does feel a bit kind of sea change, doesn't it? I mean, the word you use, resentment, is really interesting. I mean, both of us covered the 2016 election, traveled around the country. I went to a lot of Trump rallies and Republican rallies during that last election, and people would say to me, you know, I hate illegal immigration. People should come the right way. So don't you dare say that I'm racist or I don't like foreigners, because as long as they come the right way, that's what America's all about. It now turns out that even if they come the right way, if that feels like competition for jobs, then there is a political market out there for people selling restrictions on that too. So that does seem to be moving the kind of goalposts towards a much harder line position when it comes to Americans' views of foreigners.
It's true. Americans are really funny about foreigners, even about illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants. And that is, they, in theory, don't like them, resent them, the people who come here illegally. But, oh, you might have somebody who's cleaning your house who may not have their papers in order, and they might love that person individually. And so there's this kind of funny psychological thing happening in Americans' attitudes towards immigrants. But on the legal immigration front, I really think that's a distinct minority, that Americans really do support legal immigration, and that Donald Trump is, I think, really fanning these minority sentiments that even legal immigration into this country is a problem. I mean, America needs immigration to keep its population up and to support its economy. Economists will tell you that a cut to legal immigration and a cut to immigration overall would really hurt the American economy, both in its labor force and just the ability to fill jobs.
And look at the famous American companies. There's a reason why they all have foreign names. I mean, you know, Heinz and you know, you can pick any number of famous companies. Let's switch to foreign policy. So Vice President Mike Pence was on a tour of the Middle East. It was not always that easy a trip when he was in places like Jordan and Egypt. He was in some ways snubbed by some factions and leaders who thought that he represented an American government that's really taking sides in the Middle East peace dispute and essentially taking the side of the Israeli conservatives. Right. But when he got to Israel, and particularly in a speech to the Israeli Knesset, he got an endless standing ovations. What did the vice president say that made him so popular with the members of the Israeli Knesset?
He told them exactly what they want to hear. I mean, Mike Pence went to Israel as an evangelical Christian. So that's partly for domestic American reasons. I mean, American Christian evangelicals love Israel. It's the birthplace of Christianity. And so Trump comes with that posture and tells the Israelis what they want to hear, which is that they're going to deal with this bad Iran deal. They're going to not only declare, they've already declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel, they're going to set up the embassy sooner than expected.
Now, explain for listeners who are puzzled by this how you can have a big argument about which city is the capital. Mm-hmm. Where's the American embassy at the moment in Israel?
It's in Tel Aviv. The identity of the Israeli capital is a longstanding matter of dispute. Jerusalem is a divided city. So it's one of these longstanding disputes. By law, the American view of the capital of Israel is that it's Jerusalem, but every 6 months Congress has passed a sort of waiver on this to keep the actual physical building in Tel Aviv. And it's sort of a fig leaf that American politicians of both parties have gone along with for a long time, and suddenly Trump came along and blew that up.
And let's help listeners out if they don't follow Middle East peace that closely. So if the big problem of Middle East peace is that you have two nations with a claim, with overlapping claims to the same piece of land. You have the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So for the Americans to, along with a lot of other countries, keep their embassies in Tel Aviv, that was basically a sign that they were not willing to take sides in that dispute between Palestinians and Israelis. Is that basically what was going on? That it's a way of sort of signalling neutrality while the Israelis and the Palestinians wrangled over who controlled that city?
Right. And for decades, the American government has fancied itself an honest broker in trying to resolve this longstanding dispute over Israel versus the Palestinians. I mean, going back to the 70s with Jimmy Carter and his Middle East peace deal. Every American president since has tried. Now, with President Trump, he says he's trying, but he's got his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, supposedly spearheading that. And they are very pro-Israeli, very tight with Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, and it's just not credible among Palestinians.
More of Issues in the News in just a moment. This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Abdi Rahim Fakara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera TV. Our moderator is David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist.
Just before the break, we were talking about Vice President Mike Pence and his trip around the Middle East, particularly his speech to the Israeli Knesset, which went down very well, as Linda was saying, with the Israeli conservative-led government. But Abdirahim Fakara from Al Jazeera, you joined us now. Looking at the broader Middle East and their view of the United States under Donald Trump as a kind of broker for peace, what did we learn from this trip by the vice president?
I think we've learned something that we've known for a long, long time. On the Arab side, there are a lot of people, whether they admit it or not, who accept that, you know, without the United States, there cannot be any kind of settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The United States has the wherewithal to put pressure on both sides, particularly on the Palestinian side. But I think it's becoming a bit of a joke to a lot of people also on the Arab side, the notion that the United States has ever been an honest broker, as it's called. Many of these people, they say it's never been an honest broker. It's always been on the Israeli side. It's always found it easier to put pressure on the Palestinian side than on the Israeli side. And I think one of the products of the visit by Pence is that it's revived this conversation in maybe some unprecedented ways. People are now saying, even within the Palestinian Authority, as we've heard from the Palestinian Authority's President Mahmoud Abbas, that the United States has not been an honest broker. To decide to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv is further evidence, according to many of these Palestinians, that the United States, especially now, cannot at any time in the future pretend that it's going to be an honest broker. To Pence, obviously, that argument doesn't hold water because the position, his position and the position of the administration is that this, the move that is seen by the Palestinians negatively, the issue of Jerusalem. On the contrary, it may actually make reaching some sort of settlement easier than ever
because
before.
They've taken this contentious issue off the table. I think that's what
they've taken the contentious
said.
Issue off the table, and the issue of Jerusalem is very, very, very contentious. One of the most contentious issues in the Israeli-Palestinian process.
Just before we leave this Middle East segment, can I ask you one last question? So, before Vice President Pence's trip, which was delayed a bit by domestic American politics, there was this idea that the trip was basically about showing, among other things, support for hard-pressed Christians around the Middle East and persecution of Christians. In the end, some Christian Arab and Christian Palestinian leaders, I think, refused to meet him and didn't see an advantage in being seen with him. What's going on with, you know, we're very familiar with the idea of the Palestinian state in a sort of standoff with the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu. But this third element, which is so important in American domestic politics about the plight of Christians in the Middle East, how did that play out on this trip?
In significant ways, it's played out in significant ways. I mean, the relationship between the United States and the Christians of the East, as they are called in the region, is a very complex one. Because there's been mass exodus by the Christians of the East for various reasons. Some of them are political, some of them are economic. But in recent years, whether in Iraq or elsewhere, even in the Holy Land, there's been talk of serious persecution of Christians, pushing them to leave.
In very serious terrorist attacks on churches.
Exactly,
and
churches.
Egypt and,
to push them to leave in droves. But, you know, one basic fact is that the Christians of the East are the Christians of the land of Jesus Christ. And many of them resent the fact that that's often forgotten here in the United States. Many evangelists, for example, here in the United States, have often told the Christians of the East, the Christians of the land of Jesus, that unless they side with the positions of Israel, they're not true Christians. And I think many of them have heard echoes of that in the decision made by Donald Trump regarding Jerusalem, and the trip by Pence to the region has kind of solidified that feeling among many communities of the Christians of the East.
That's absolutely fascinating. Well, we could talk about the Middle East for the whole program, but let's talk about something else that has really serious economic consequences here in the United States. So, Linda, when we were talking about immigration, we talked about free trade and how, obviously, Donald Trump at least campaigned as someone willing to impose protectionist barriers. He hasn't done a whole lot of actual protectionist kind of legislating and order issuing. But he did slap import tariffs on solar panels and washing machines, using powers that, it has to be said, President Obama and his predecessor George W. Bush did use in limited ways. Let's start with the claim by Donald Trump that this is going to create lots and lots of jobs. Is that undisputed, or is there actually dispute about that?
No, this is a highly disputed claim, and the administration has made clear that these tariffs on washing machines and solar panels are just the beginning. You know, in Donald Trump's first year, he was focused on trying to overturn President Obama's health care reform and to reform the tax code. He failed on the first, succeeded on the second. So now we're in year two, and the follow-up act is to implement his protectionist goals. And this was the first salvo. Where this is going, it could be very bad. The Korean manufacturer, LG, has already announced...
Of washing machines, exactly.
Has already announced retaliation. So we could be heading right into a trade war.
And Abdurrahim, let's look at this question of solar panels. So the claim is that if you put a tariff on solar panels, make solar panels made in places like Malaysia, some still made in China, if you make them more expensive, then jobs will suddenly emerge inside America making solar panels. But you've seen other bits of the solar panel industry go, whoa, you know, wait, this is a growing industry for sure, but most of the American jobs aren't involved in making the panels. What's been going on?
Obviously, for Donald Trump, this is part of what he promised, to do everything he can in terms of relations with China to put in place the America, his America First slogan. And as we've been hearing in recent days, particularly with him being in Davos, now he's been saying that America First does not mean America alone. He's saying, I'm willing to work with the Europeans, to work with the Chinese and others, but I have to safeguard American interests. But when you look at some of the figures, as you mentioned, the solar industry here in the United States, some of the figures being floated are, yes, it will help to a certain extent create jobs here in the United States, fractionally. What it will do on a larger scale, however, is create jobs and opportunities not within the industry of actually manufacturing solar panels, but in the services that go with solar panels.
Because it's actually a giant industry. Now you have tens of thousands of Americans whose job is to put the solar panels on people's roofs. And that's actually, I think, more people are employed in that than in the entire coal industry, which gets so much more political attention.
Exactly.
Are they worried about the effects of, if these panels get more expensive, that you could actually see fewer people wanting to stick them on their roof?
Well, I mean, if you look at the percentage of the tariffs that Donald Trump wants to impose, he's talking about 30%. And obviously, we're hearing, by the way, a lot of noises from the Chinese. Still, the noises that we could have heard from the Chinese had he decided to make the percentage 40 or 50% are significantly less. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes some way towards mollifying the concerns here in the United States about the issue that you've just raised.
So that was Donald Trump making a kind of domestic political point about America First within the United States. Linda, let's just turn finally to Donald Trump visiting Davos, the big kind of gathering of global kind of bigwigs, business and political leaders in the Swiss Alps. He gave a speech that was, it was not the most ferocious, but it was basic. What did he say about sort of America First and how that works?
Well, he said America First doesn't mean America alone. It means America as part of the world, but representing American interests. And, America is engaged with the world. We're not going to become some autarky like North Korea, where we just close our borders completely and don't interact with the rest of the world.
And he's talking about America being open for business and
exactly.
tax cuts as a signal to invest in America.
Right. But he also, in some ways, shows his naivete. In an interview before his speech at Davos, he talked about wanting to try to get back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Well, that horse has left the barn. I mean, it's just too late for that. So I think this, in some ways, Donald Trump can talk a good game, but when he gets into the detail, he just shows a certain lack of understanding about policy.
Abdurrahim, can I just finish by asking about Donald Trump's constant kind of salesmanship for nationalism? So his pitch is that, yes, he's America First, but that's how the whole world should be, that every national leader should put their own country unashamedly first, and that relationships between countries would be happier and more profitable if every country was unashamedly nationalist and did everything bilaterally. You come from a region of the world which has seen mixed results from nationalism. I come from Europe, a continent which has seen mixed results from nationalism. Does the rest of the world hear that message about the good side of nationalism with the same ears that, say, Trump supporters do?
I think on the surface of it, what Donald Trump is saying sounds really, really, really good. America First does not mean America alone, and I am defending the interests of the United States, and you should be defending the interests of your country, whatever that country is. But if you dig deeper in that slogan, there's also chaos. If we all start vociferously chasing the interests of our own country the way he seems to want to do, then, that's definitely a recipe for conflict, like we've seen conflicts in Europe and the Second World War, for example, like we're currently seeing conflicts in the Middle East.
And Linda, presumably, if you're a foreign leader, it sounds a bit like a kind of giant gorilla saying, let's decide everything in a one-on-one wrestling match, and I'll start. And, of course, America fancies one-on-one wrestling matches because it is the biggest economy in the world still. Right. I mean, China catching up fast. Is that why do you think some of the audience will have been a bit wary of his message in Davos?
Absolutely. I mean, I think history has shown that multilateralism is very effective, even when there's one member of a coalition dwarfs the others. It's, and I think Donald Trump has shown that he's not going to go whole hog for the one-on-one deal. I mean, he still supports NATO, and he's not calling for the breakup of the European Union. I mean, he's acknowledging that the EU will still exist. So he makes his points, but then reality kicks in, and it's not quite as extreme as it sounds.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you to Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and to Abdurrahim Fakhara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera TV. This programme is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie of The Economist. Thanks for listening.